This is Ms. G, bringing you Telling Tales here at 104.3 KTOO. I have two stories tonight by the wonderful Fernando Sorrentino. So I'll give you a chance to get settled, and I'll be right back with more. Please stay tuned. Hello, this is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at KTO 104.3. And the first story by Fernando Sorrentino is titled The Library of Mabel Mogoburo. It's translated from the Spanish by Gustavo Artiles and Sean Barnett. As a sufferer of a sort of classificatory mania from adolescence, I took great care in cataloging the books in my library. By the fifth year of secondary school, I already possessed, for my age, a very reasonable number of books, about 600 volumes. I had a rubber stamp with the following legend, Library of Fernando Sorrentino, volume number, registered on. As soon as a new book arrived, I stamped it, always in black ink on its first page. I gave it its corresponding number, always in blue ink, and wrote its date of acquisition. Then, imitating the old National Library's catalog, I entered its details on an index card, which I filed in alphabetical order. My sources of literary information were the editorial catalogs and the Pinguino Larousse Ilustrado. An example at random in many collections from the various editors was Italia, René, and the Adventures of the Last Abencarage. Motivated by such ubiquity and because the Larousse seemed to give Chateaubriand such great importance, I acquired the book in the Collection Austral edition from Espace Cap. In spite of these precautions, those three stories turned out to be as unreadable as they were unmemorable. In contrast to these failures, there were also complete successes. In the Robin Hood collection, I was captivated by David Copperfield, and in the Biblioteca Mundial Sopeña by Crime and Punishment. Along the even-numbered side of Santa Fe Avenue, a short distance from Emilio Ravignani Street, was the half-hidden Munoz bookshop. It was dark, deep, humid, and moldy, with creaking wooden planks. Its owner was a Spanish man, about 60 years old, very serious and somewhat haggard. The only sales assistant was the person who used to serve me. He was young, bold, and error-prone, and had neither knowledge of the books he was asked about nor any idea of where they were located. His name was Horatio. When I entered the premises that afternoon, Horatio was rummaging around some shelves, looking for a heaven knows what title. I managed to learn that a tall, thin girl had inquired about it. She was, in the meantime, browsing the wide table where the second-hand books were on display. From the depths of the shop, the owner's voice was heard. "What are you looking for now, Horatio?" The adverb now indicated a bad mood. I can't find Don Segundo Sombra, Don Antonio. It is not on the MSC shelves. It is a Losado book, not MSC. Look on the shelves of the Contemporanea. Horatio changed the location of his search and, after a great deal of hunting, turned toward the girl and said, "No, I am sorry. We have no Don Segundo left." The girl expressed disappointment, said she needed it for school, and asked where she could find it. Horatio, embarrassed in the face of such an insoluble problem, stared at her wide-eyed and raised his eyebrows. Luckily, Don Antonio had overheard. "Around here," he answered, "it is very hard. There are no good bookshops. You will have to go to the center of town, to El Antonio, or somewhere in Florida or Corrientes, or perhaps near Cabildo and Juramento." The girl's face fell. "Forgive me for barging in," I said to her, "but if you promise to take care of it and return it to me, I can lend you Don Segundo Sombra." I felt as if I was blushing, as if I had been inconceivably audacious. At the same time, I felt annoyed with myself for having given in to an impulse that was contrary to how I really felt. I love my books and hate lending them. I don't know what exactly the girl answered, but after some squeamishness, she ended up accepting my offer. "I have to read it immediately for school," she explained, as if to justify herself. I learned that she was in the third year in the women's college at Carranza Street. I suggested that she accompany me home and I would hand over the book. I gave her my full name and she gave me hers. Her name was Mabel Mogoburu. Before starting our journey, I accomplished what had taken me to the Munoz bookshop about the murders in the Rue Morgue. I already had the tales of the grotesque and arabesque, and with much delight decided to dive once again into the fiction of Edgar Allan Poe. "I don't like him at all," Mabel said. "He is gruesome and gimmicky, always with those stories of murders, of dead people, of coffins. Cadavers don't appeal to me." While we walked along Carranza toward Costa Rica Street, Mabel spoke enthusiastically and honestly about her interest in, or rather passion, for literature. Because of that, there was a deep affinity between us, though, of course, she mentioned authors that differed from, as well as matched, my own literary loves. Although I was 2 years older than her, it seemed to me that Mabel had read considerably more books than me. She was a brunette, taller and thinner than I had thought in the bookshop. She had a certain diffused elegance about her. The olive shade of her face seemed to hide some deeper paleness. The dark eyes were fixed straight on mine, and I found it hard to withstand the intensity of that steady stare. We arrived at my door in Costa Rica Street. "Wait for me on the pavement. I'll bring you the book right away." And I did find the book instantly, as, for the sake of consistency, I had, and still have, my books grouped by collection. Thus, Don Segundo Sombra, Biblioteca Contemporanea, Editorial Losada, was placed between Kafka's The Metamorphosis and Chesterton's The Innocence of Father Brown. Back in the street, I noticed, although I know nothing about clothes, that Mabel was dressed in a somewhat, shall we say, old-fashioned style, with a grayish blouse and black skirt. "As you can see," I told her, "this book looks brand new, as if I had just bought it a moment ago in Don Antonio's bookshop. Please take care of it. Put a cover on it. Don't fold the papers as a marker, and most importantly, don't even think of writing even a comma on it." She took the book, such long and beautiful hands, with what I thought was a certain mocking respect. The volume, in impeccable orange color, looked as if it had just left the press. She leafed through the pages for a while. "But I see that you do write on your books," she said. "Certainly, but I use a pencil, writing very carefully in very small handwriting. Those are notes and useful observations to enrich my reading. Besides," I added, slightly irritated, "the book belongs to me, and I can do what I like with it." I immediately regretted my rudeness, as I saw Mabel was mortified. "Well, if you don't trust me, I'd prefer not to borrow it." And she handed it back to me. "No, not at all. Just take care of it. I trust you." "Oh," she was looking at the first page, "you have your books classified." And she read in loud voice, not jokingly, "Library of Fernando Sorrentino, volume number 232, registered on 23-4-1957. "That's right. I bought it when I was in the second year of secondary school. The teacher assigned it for our work in Spanish lit classes. I found the few short stories I've read by Guarados rather poor. That's why I never thought of getting Don Segundo. I think you are going to like it. At least there are no coffins or cursed houses or people buried alive. When do you think you'll be returning it? You'll have it back within a fortnight, as radiant, she emphasized, as it is now. And to make you feel less worried, I'm giving you my address and telephone number. That's not necessary, I said out of politeness. She took out a ballpoint pen and a school notebook from her purse and wrote something on the last page. Then she tore it out and I accepted it. To be sure, I gave her my telephone number, too. Well, I am very grateful. I am going home now. She shook my hand, no kisses at that time, as is the way now, and she walked toward the Bonpland corner. I felt some discomfort. Had I made a mistake, lending my precious book to a complete stranger? Could the information she had given me be made up? The page from the notebook was squared, the ink green. I searched the phone book for the name Mogoburo. I sighed with relief, and Mogoburo, Onario, was listed next to the address written by Mabel. I placed a card between the Metamorphosis and the Innocence of Father Brown with the legend Don Segundo Sombra, missing, lent to Mabel Mogoburo on Tuesday, 7th of June, 1960. She promised to return it at the latest on Wednesday, 22nd of June. Under it, I added her address and phone number. Then, on the page of my agenda for the 22nd of June, I wrote, Mabel, attention, Don Segundo. That week and the next went by. I continued with my usual, mostly unappreciated activities as a student in my last year of secondary school. It was the afternoon of Thursday, the 23rd. As often happens, even to this day, I had written a note in my agenda that I later forgot to read. Mabel had not called me to return the book or to ask me to extend the loan. I dialed Onario Mogoburo's number. At the other end, the bell rang 10 times, but nobody answered. I hung up, but called again many times at different times, with the same fruitless result. This pattern was repeated on Friday afternoon. Saturday morning, I went to Mabel's home on Arevalo Street, between Guatemala and Paraguay. Before ringing the bell, I watched the house from across the street, a typical Palermo Viejo construction, the door in the middle of the facade and a window on each side. I could see some light through one of them. Was Mabel in that room, engrossed in her reading? A tall, dark man opened the door. I imagine he must be Mabel's grandfather. What can I do for you? I beg your pardon, is this Mabel Mogoburo's home? Yes, but she is not here right now. I am her father. What do you want her for? Is it something urgent? No, it's nothing urgent or very important. I had lent her a book and, well, I need it now for, I search for a reason, a test I have on Monday. Come in, please. Beyond the hallway, there was a small living room that appeared poor and old-fashioned to me. A certain unpleasant smell of stale tomato sauce mixed with insecticide floated in the air. On a small side table, I could see the newspaper, La Prensa, and there was a copy of Mecánica Popular. The man moved extremely slowly. He had a strong resemblance to Mabel, the same olive skin and hard stare. What book did you lend her? Don Segundo Sombra. Let's go to Mabel's room and see if we can find it. I felt a little ashamed for troubling this elderly man that seemed so down on his luck, who lived in such a sad house. Don't bother, I told him. I can return some other day when Mabel is here. There is no rush. But didn't you say that you needed it for Monday? He was right, so I chose not to say anything. Mabel's bed was covered with an embroidered quilt with a faded shine. He took me to a tiny bookcase with only 3 shelves. These are Mabel's books. See if you can find the one you want. I don't think there can have been 100 books there. There were many from Editorial Tour, among which I recognized, because I too had that edition from 1944, The Phantom of the Opera with its dreadful covered picture. And I spotted other common titles always in rather old editions. But Don Segundo wasn't there. I took you here so you wouldn't worry, said the man. But Mabel hasn't brought books to this library for many years. You can see that these are pretty old, right? Yes, I was surprised not to see more recent books. If you agree and have the time and the inclination, he fixed his eyes on me, which made me lower mine, We can settle this matter right now. Let's look for your book in Mabel's library. He put on his glasses and shook a key ring. In my car, we'll be there in less than 10 minutes. The car was a huge black DeSoto that I imagine was a 46 or 47 model. Inside, it smelled of stale air and moldy tobacco. Mogadburu went around the corner and entered Durango. We soon reached La Cruz, Corrientes, Guzman, and we turned onto the inner roads of the Chacarita Cemetery. We got out of the car and started walking along the cobbled paths. My blessed or cursed literary curiosity compelled me to follow him without a question through an area filled with crypts. At one of them with the name Mogadburu on his facade, he pulled out a key and opened the black iron door. "Come on," he said. "Don't be afraid." Although I didn't want to, I obeyed him, at the same time resenting his allusion to my supposed fear. I entered the crypt and descended a small metal ladder. I saw two coffins. "In this box," the man pointed to the other lower one, "is Maria Rosa, my wife, who died the same day Frondizi was made president." He tapped the top several times with his knuckles. "And this one belongs to my daughter, Mabel. She died, the poor thing, so young. She was barely 15 when God took her away in May of 1945. Last month was 15 years since her death. She would be 30 now." He leaned slightly over the coffin and smiled as if recalling a fond memory. Death and all his unfairness couldn't keep her away from her great passion, literature. She continued restlessly reading book after book. "Can you see? Here is Mabel's other library, more complete and up-to-date than the one at home." It was true. One wall of the crypt was covered almost floor to ceiling, I assume because of lack of space, by hundreds of books, most of them in a horizontal position and in double rows. She was very methodical, filling the shelves from top to bottom and left to right. "Therefore, your book, being a recent loan, must be on the half-full shelf on the right." A strange force led me to that shelf, and there it was, my Don Segundo. "In general," Mogadburu continued, "not many people come to claim their borrowed books. I can see you love them very much." I fixed my eyes on the first page of Don Segundo. A very large green X blotted out my stamp and my intonation. Under it, the same ink and with the same careful writing in uppercase letters, there were three lines. "Library of Mabel Mogadburu, Volume 5328, 7th of June of 1960. "The Buddha," I thought, even after I told her not to write even a comma. "Well, that's the way things go," the mother father was saying. "Are you taking the book or leaving it as a donation to Mabel's library?" Angrily and rather abruptly, I replied, "Of course I'm taking it with me. I'm not in the habit of giving away my books." "You are doing the right thing," he replied while he climbed the ladder. "Mabel will soon find another copy." That was Fernando Sorrentino's The Library of Mabel Mogadburu. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at KTOO 104.3, and I'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Hi, this is Ms. G. I'm bringing Telling Tales here tonight, but first I wanted to be sure to tell you about the Rouge Canadier November Open Mic. It's going to be Friday, November 20th at 6:30 p.m. at the Mendenhall Valley Library. The optional theme is Remembrance. This is a non-competitive free event open to the public. Poets and performers of all ages and all abilities are invited to participate. Sign-ups at 6 p.m. and open mic at 6:30. It's hosted by DJ Drago with the Rouge Canadier House Band. You can also follow Rouge Canadier on Facebook for more details. So that's open mic night this Friday, November 20th at 6:30 p.m. at the Mendenhall Valley Library. So check that out and maybe you'll find yourself performing. And before I get off the air for tonight, I also wanted to give you another Fernando Sorrentino story. I hope you enjoyed that last one. This one is titled, here we go, Going Back to Our Roots. It's translated from the Spanish by Iris Maria Miolenin. I tend to instantly accept any idea proposed by a sociologist or psychoanalyst during televised round tables. Emerging among eyeglasses, beers, and pipe smoke, the deep and indisputable male voice propounded that modern humans have been objectified and that little by little the consumer, society, has been consuming them. I got scared in a dizzying mental process, which there is no point in describing, but which is easily imagined, propelled me to immediately turn off the television and hurry to the Sursorio Hermanas bicycle shop in my neighborhood of Villa Ocroza. I do not know how many Sursorio brothers there are, as there was only one very thin man with high cheekbones in the shop. He turned out to be clever, efficient, and quick. As he was selling me the bicycle, he let fall a few sentences of the kind a teacher would say to a disciple. This is the best thing you could have done. Life has become hopelessly complicated. A bicycle is simple, and even though it is a mechanical device, it entails natural things, fresh air, sunshine, and exercise. I agreed. Feeling rather childishly happy, I got on the bicycle and headed out on the streets of Villa Ogurza and Periodon. After a few minutes, I ended up in Villa Lynch in Santos Lugares in El Palomar. Amazing, I said to myself. The simple and aesthetic vehicle lets me cover long distances in a fairly short time. Yes, but how far did I really go? Since I abhor imprecision and conjecture, I went to see Mr. Sursorio again. This time he looked at me with a serious and uncertain air. There seemed to be a perceptible shift in his attitude. Remember, he said, it was your idea to come back. I answered with sententious flattery. A satisfied customer always returns to an honest merchant. I asked whether he thought it would be a good idea to improve the bicycle with an odometer. He scolded me. An odometer without a speedometer is like a fork without a knife. They complement each other, and one gives the other a reason to exist. The odometer will tell you how far you've traveled, and the speedometer will let you know how strong your idle are. I admitted he was right, and in a few minutes, the two devices were attached to the handlebars of my bicycle. People wander about engrossed in themselves or they are born fools, said Mr. Sursorio. So don't be surprised if you run into some absent-minded person. How about an electric horn to round out a terrific trio? I'm sorry to disagree with you, but I hate the honking of horns. This horn comes from the Empire of the Rising Sun, he lectured, and perhaps you know that the Japanese try to save space. There is no larger than a matchbox, and even if you don't appreciate the melody of a honking urban horn, you can still enjoy the extras. A boombox with cassette player and recorder, a wind clock showing the official time in Tokyo, Addis Ababa, and Tegucigalpa. A temperature and atmospheric pressure indicator, and a 57-function mini calculator in case you need to do sums along the way. Given all those features, I was very happy to buy the horn. What about the weather? Asked Mr. Sursorio next. It was a rhetorical question. It's a wonderful, a radiant day, he answered himself. January in Buenos Aires fries the brains of anyone lucky enough to have any. But don't be surprised when you get caught in a savage storm in the most desolate spot and return home with 1,000 gallons of water in your clothes and shoes. I puzzled for a moment. He added, on the threshold of the 21st century, would anyone who was not an idiot let himself get wet when there was this little device? He held a kind of Lilliputian television set in the palm of his hand. It predicts changes in weather 72 hours in advance and with zero margin of error. He rapidly screwed it onto the handlebars. It also shows isobars and isohyas of Australia and Gabon, gives you information on tides in the Persian Gulf, and has an ultrasonic system that exterminates the porcupines, wild dogs, and iguanas that lie in wait for cyclists on the roads. What about mosquitoes and flies? Unfortunately, the despicable dipterans have developed immunity to the foolproof rays of this device. But what does that matter when it also makes copies that are one or two-sided in color and on any kind of paper? Since I spend so much time making copies, this feature won me over. The rear fender, noted Suosario, shouldn't feel inferior to the handlebars. There are all these wonders on the handlebars and nothing in the back. He mounted a butter dish-sized metal box with buttons and levers behind the seat. You're a bit of a slacker and you probably overeat and enjoy your food. When fierce hunger pains strike en route, is there anything better than this infrared oven for roasting a chicken or a cut of beef with potatoes and onions in only 25 seconds while the distillers turn the moisture in the air into burgundy wine? The offer was tempting and I was not strong enough to resist. I was born in this town. I've lived in Villa Igurza for 53 years, he proffered, raising his voice in his right arm. And I have always thought that the neighborhood is like a big family. You don't look sneaky, so I'll risk it and trust that you're honest. I'll give you credit in dollars to be paid off in 36 easy monthly installments. To save you the trouble of going to my laboratory, give me your address, which I already know by heart, and tomorrow my financial manager will go to your house with some documents for you to sign. I shakily wrote the address in the margin of a newspaper. Fearing he would forget his promise, I urged, he will come tomorrow for sure, right? Of course he'll come. He'll be bearing promissory notes, crying out for bankrupt signatures and brochures for other scientific advances that will make your jaw drop. I congratulate you once more. This is the best thing you could have done. Life has become hopelessly complicated and a bicycle is simple and natural. Moved, I answered, thank you so much. I mounted and pedaled away happy, full of life, with a song on my lips. That was Fernando Sorrentino's Going Back to Our Roots. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G. I hope you enjoyed tonight's stories. Until next time, good night.